Georgi Stegmanos was a fearsome kingpin in the Greek mafia of the early 20th century. His business enterprises, such as gambling, loan corking, and destitution, permeated the daily life from Agrinion to Zakynthos, and most every Greek community in between.
When early in the 20th century?
Oh, exactly. Let's say about early.
19 what?
Yeah, 19 what? Exactly, 1901.
I'm just curious about the quarking, you know.
Quarking?
Yes.
Then say 1904.
Well done.
Yes.
All right.
Ah, good. Stegmore made a lot of money. He also made a lot of enemies. To deal with the latter, he surrounded himself with a retinue of bodyguards, including suspending at least two of them overhead at all times. Even when he met with his supposedly trusty underlings, he never appeared without several inflatable body doubles present. His precautions worked. The National Greek Police Force estimated that he survived 481 assassination attempts. The 482nd, however, was a different story. Stegmanos also maintained a pool of floozies. Socrates, Epicurus, Pythagoras, Euclid, Platomato.
Euclid?
Euclid.
is that like bulimia clid?
No, it's Euclid.
Euclid. Is beauty is
yes.
Clid. I see.
With whom he spent many hours conducting, quote, market research, end quote. During one of these sessions, he discovered that Platomato was an accomplished pianist. She had attended West Athens College of Musettes and graduated summa cum laude.
Ah.
With a degree in Greek folk music. There was, however, more to Platomato than met Stegmanos' ogling eye. One day, she was performing a rembetiko for him on the parlor piano. No matter, Stegmanos had booby-trapped it with all sorts of defensive ordnance. But he assured her that if she played only the white keys, no harm would come to them. She batted her big, they were half a meter wide at least, brown eyes at him, and patted the space next to her on the piano bench, and he willingly sat down beside her. The rembetiko was the music of the downtrodden, the Greek equivalent of the blues, and Platomato was pouring her heart and soul into the piece. Stegmanos was patently moved, and he abruptly bade his bodyguards leave them alone for a while. They protested and only obeyed when he inflated one of his overly protective body doubles. The music hit an especially emotional peak, quite a challenge when all of the black notes were taboo. And then, according to Euclid's tell-all autobiography, four things happened in rapid succession.
One,
Stegmanos jumped up in the throes of passion.
Two,
Platomato pressed the B-flat below middle C and...
Three.
Ducked. And...
Four.
A solid fuel rocket launched from the rest plank straight into the little crease between the flabbergasted kingpin's peepers. As Platomato escaped through a secret passageway in the armoire with the inflatable doppelganger in hot pursuit, a most remarkable transmogrification occurred. Instead of blowing him to smithereens, the rocket turned Stegmanos into a form of kinetic energy that was instantly absorbed by the piano. By the time his bodyguards had broken down the door and re-secured the room, the piano was already haunted. Bruno Katsanzakis, a middle management hoodlum from Crete, assumed... What's the matter?
Never mind. That's a great concept.
Ah.
Especially with that name.
He assumed control of Stegmanos' empire. Like his predecessor, he surrounded himself with hired muscle and libertine floozies. But unlike Stegmanos, he reviled music, and he ordered the piano be moved out of the house. That, however, was easier said than done. When the team of movers came for it, the F-sharp above middle C depressed itself, activating the depth charge catapult. The resultant explosion splattered shards of movers all over the walls of that and an adjoining room. Katsenzakis was a trifle uneasy when he discovered that the piano was undamaged. Unease turned to downright fear when it began to play by itself. It was a dismal approximation of a rembetiko, but the symbolism was lost on Katsenzakis.
Crouton belted for the...
An E-flat minor arpeggio dispatched a dozen poison-tipped kubutans in his direction. Only one hit its target, but one was enough. Mafioso after mafioso attempted to take over Stekmanos' kingpindom, and each met a similarly deadly fate. By the time Platomato, still dogged by that pesky inflatable doll... slipped back into the room through the armoire's secret door 2 years later, the piano's weapons had all been discharged. She calmly slid a dolly under the piano and wheeled it out of the house and into a waiting van.
An inflatable dolly?
Yes.
I'm very confused by this.
Hello.
Hello.
Dolly.
Dolly.
The van delivered the piano to a cargo ship, which sailed at once for New York. As bizarre as it may seem, things were proceeding according to plan. Platomato's real name was Ruby Primavera, and she was a marketing consultant for George Steck Pianos of New York.
Ruby!
Yes.
It's Ruby! Ruby Primavera! Hey! All right!
Her company's products had typically merited only a satisfactory rating by the piano shendy of the world. That's pretty satisfactory. And she had been given the task of correcting that perception. But she soon realized that the perception was based on fact. The pianos simply didn't measure up to the Steinbecks and Wurlitzers of the era. On the other hand, America was eagerly embracing the new millennium's piano player technology, and Ruby saw an opportunity for the company's growth in that arena.
Piano player technology.
Yes, piano player technology.
Player piano technology.
Player piano.
I see. Player
piano.
I didn't understand. That is explaining
player
these.
Piano.
Yeah, I see.
Yes.
All right. It's much more clear.
Oh,
now.
Good. It is. Oh.
Yeah.
How she figured out that a similarly named mobster from overseas might lend his essence to the post-pneumatic technology of what became known as a, quote, reproducing piano, end quote, thereby revolutionizing the pianola industry, may never be known. But as soon as the eccentricities of the Greek thug's parlor piano were incorporated into the design of George Steck pianos, its player piano division quickly became hugely popular. And while the piano roles may have sported titles like Moonlight Sonata or Gaspard de la Nuit, the performances invariably took on the bluesy color of the rembetiko. The color of today's 472nd episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar is more sepia-toned than blue.
Well, that's giving us a lot of credit.
Yeah. The better to reflect the tonal leanings of an in-studio tunesmith who presently awaits, with apprehension, the opening salvo of indelicate queries from Damien and especially Calvos.
Ah, yes. All right, I have nothing useful to say after that, because
nope.
It was so rich and full of nuance.
Do you know about when George Steck started designing player pianos?
I don't. I just count on you to do the research.
I did the research.
And I just suck it up like a sponge mop.
Or it's like a quotidian sponge mop.
That too.
Yes. But we do have someone studio-bound.
Yes, who's...
Not bound, yes.
Whose name was named in the first piece we heard. We're listening right now to music by Eric Schwartz. And back from this one, onward back, we have When We Scream. That's this one.
Mm.
Things Fall Apart. Gosh, everyone likes that.
Yeah.
Love Song for Aaron, The Beelzebub Rag, Underwater Love, and beginning with Prelude, Elliot's Funky Shuffle. And our guest today is Elliot Handelman. He's down here from an alien country, one that borders Vermont, and somehow we're not sure whether that's by choice on either side.
Is he
it's true.
Planning to do some sort of funky shuffle?
He might be planning some funky shuffle, but before we Before we get to the funky shuffle, let's listen to the rest of When We Scream, followed by Epilogue. This is music by Eric Schwartz. Music by Eric Schwartz from his CD 24 Ways of Looking at a Piano. We heard the prelude, Elliot's Funky Shuffle, Underwater Love, The Beelzebub, Brag, Love Song for Erin, Things Fall Apart, When We Scream, and finishing up with Epilogue. There are number 7 through 23 we did not play.
Is he any relation to Elliot?
I have no idea. He's got an E and a Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I know.
Close enough.
We have a guest.
Not Elliot. Schwartz.
No, we have a guest whose first name is an Elliot, indeed.
He's
going to introduce himself.
Well, or not.
Or not, depending on whether there's microphone.
I think that's long turned up.
There he is.
Hello, yes, I'm Elliot.
Elliot Handelman's here. You've come down from...
I'm not Elliot Schwartz, but I do eat at Schwartz.
Ah, isn't that great
smoked meat
deli?
That's
a great place on the side street.
It's just one of the things that one learns to do with that in Vermont.
It's yummy. I haven't been there in years. Absolutely yummy. They still have the big jars of pickles in the window there?
He's
have huge jars of pickles.
They were sold.
What?
I'm
the
sorry.
Pickles were sold?
Yeah.
The jars were sold.
Oh, yeah.
The place was sold.
Are we missing some
moving
syntax
on to the
here?
Next theme.
Welcome, Elliot.
Thank you.
Wait, you come from where?
From Montreal.
I see. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Do you have anything that you... Any more detail we want to go into?
Yeah, what part of Montreal?
I live in the old part of Montreal called Lachine, which means China. And the idea was that the discoverer of Montreal, or the European discoverer of Montreal, who I think was Jacques Cartier, but it might have been Samuel de Champlain, because I'm not completely sure. And I don't know how anybody really could be.
It certainly wasn't Vasco da Gama.
He had been commissioned to find a northwest or northeast trade route to China. And he landed up instead in North America. So the cynical French land grant officer decided to name the place China. And this is where I happen to live. the ancient fur trading capital of North America, where canoes would paddle up the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence River, to do battle with the frost.
Something sounds
trap
like
animals, skin them alive.
And club baby seals, yes.
Club baby seals.
Thank you very
and
much.
And so you were drawn to this location with the seals.
I was drawn to it for a number of the reasons. The first is an instinctive native love of water, and it happens to be by the water. The second is a kind of interest in old falling apart parts of cities, bordering on but not quite attaining to slumminess, makes me feel very comfortable and also connects me with a sense of interiority that I wish to pursue in moving to Lachine to begin with, because I went there. I'd been living elsewhere. I was everywhere. I was in New York and in California, and I spent time in Europe.
All three of the places have water, we understand.
Do all of these places, which places did I just name? New York has water.
And
yeah.
California has
yeah,
water.
Yeah, California and Europe, could be said to have water.
And Europe, I yeah. understand there's water in there. Calvus
well,
went to a place
there,
that
well,
has
I lived
water.
In Berlin, and supposedly, which I noticed we happened to be in Berlin again.
Exactly.
Is this Berlin?
No, yeah, right. This is Plainfield.
Oh, this, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it doesn't jive with my recollections of Berlin, but, you know, things supposedly have changed since
exactly.
unification.
Right, so, the water, they've imported water to Berlin.
Yeah, yeah. Berlin supposedly was, if I may throw it, a kind of travel
do
guide.
That.
We are going to be pelted okay. with a combination of irrelevancies and...
digressions, and holding off as long as possible until we get to the substance.
And verbal running over the hosts of the show.
Right, so let's not mince words. Berlin had the greatest number of canals of any, and no, of bridges, I believe, of any other city in Europe. And that was just West Berlin, I believe.
You mean the ones so, they rebuilt since they were all sort of blown up about 60 years ago?
Well, it's just a city. Well, I don't know how to respond to that, but I don't know if it's true or not, but Berlin is a very, very watery kind of city with a lot of rivers. And
is it diluted? Going.
It's
diluted sort of
polluted,
city.
Does this affect your compositional style at all?
My compositional style.
We can't get to the compositional style. This is
have
a dangerous question.
Sorry.
We have to go to the official biographical
part. Let's keep
digressing.
Let's get into Schwartz's
Elliot Handelman's early days as a composer. Your early days.
My early days.
Yes. How did you get into it? Where did you get into it? And how did you end up in Berlin, for example?
Excellent question.
In that order, please.
Yeah. Okay.
Early days.
In that order.
8 o'clock.
Okay, we're going to have to start again. But I assume that the main line was how come I was interested in trying to attain my own compositional identity in a place like Berlin.
I would never ask it that way, but yes.
Okay. This partly is in one of the pieces that we might be hearing.
Or might not,
depending on how the time goes.
Who knows where it goes.
Exactly. Question I've been asking myself for the last 20 years.
We're going to take a technical shift right here. Would you please switch microphones? Yes. There's a hum in Elliot's microphone, and I can turn yours down while he's talking.
This would not be untypical of the relationship that I have with technology.
Much better.
Okay. So the hum is gone?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, you were asking about the pursuit of compositional identity
oh,
in old
sure.
Europe, an old shattered ancient part of Europe, which had a very specific, ungermane relation to my own ethnicity. You want me to move closer or further? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, now that we've broken the line of thought. The answer was I went to Berlin to try to locate myself within a whole tide of things that I seemed disconnected from, or which seemed only to have a kind of symbolic meaning to me. One was the sense of intense fascination that I have with German culture, you know, Thomas Mann, with Faust myths and that kind of thing. Another was the feeling that the legitimate music for me, the thing that I was most passionate about, was somehow invariably connected to Germany. German music just always felt like, you know, that was it.
Kraftwerk.
Yeah, Kraftwerk, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Einstürzen der Neubauten.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, but that, too, has a kind of, like, special seriousness about it that maybe, I don't know, because I'm not that knowledgeable about that kind of music. Maybe it has a kind of special seriousness. When Germans want to do that kind of thing, they do it very seriously. Balzac made a famous comment about Germans. When a German wants to seem elegant, he leaps out the window.
Okay.
Things are always done in great excess in Germany. And the kind of particular magic that we find in music, the kind of dark irrationalism that always tied me to music, was something that also seemed connected with all of these different hard-to-negotiate facts of modern Germany, Holocaust, Auschwitz, Second World War, the German soul, and that kind of thing. And I didn't know. I was just drawn to try. So I wound up studying with a Korean, Lee Sang-yoon.
That seems appropriate somehow. What year was
Let's start all over again. I'm giving a different lecture to kill more time.
I didn't want
to go to Europe. I wanted to go to New York. I just thought Europe would be a lot cheaper, and I went to Paris.
And you were right.
And I was right. You could live incredibly cheaply in Paris at the time in 1978. I paid like $50 a month for my place, and I decided that I wanted to study music again because I didn't feel that I had studied properly the first time around. And so I went to Berlin. It was being a very fascinating city. I had originally hoped to work with Ligeti in Hamburg. I found Berlin more interesting and just decided to stay, and I was there for about 7 years. So
this is about what year?
We're talking 79 to 80, 86, I lived there. Yeah. So then after that, am I continuing with this autobiographical suite, or do you want to interject
another
with questions?
Another 10 like seconds, and then we'll...
I'll listen to a little music?
Yeah.
You want me to set up a little music?
What, set up? Yeah. Well, eventually we will set up the music, but I want to sort of jump into...
I talk on the radio all the time. I have my show. I never play my music, though.
we may not have to do that either.
One of the things that... had you invited to this show was your penchant for a kind of philosophical questioning, a constant set of philosophical questions that would pop up every time you were asked about your music or sometimes other people's music. We'd say, why do you compose, or what's this have to do with great music, or almost any question. Where did this sort of philosophical bent arise?
Okay, I'm not sure if I can really identify with what does this have to do with great music?
Well, that's not the specific question, but rather if there's ever sort of a definitive statement made about music, I will find you jumping into the Canadian Electric Acoustic Community discussion forum with a kind of a questioning of the certainty of almost any statement.
Because for me, music is basically about chaos. It's not about certainty. And it's about exploring my inner chaos compositionally. Listening, I think, also connects us with, as I was trying to say about Berlin, with a kind of irrationalism or darkness within us that, you know, maybe you feel if you like German romantic music, Strauss or Mahler, that kind of thing, you know. You were laughing.
Well, yeah, darkness. Strauss. I don't associate that. You're talking about Richard Strauss.
R. Strauss, yeah.
R. Strauss. Okay, yeah. Well, that's...
But maybe there's a kind of darkness in J. Strauss as well, you know, that maybe Kubrick kind of exploited at the beginning, you know, the timeless quality of the Blue Danube. catch these mosquitoes flying around.
We have a mosquito-ridden kind of studio.
So I jump in. Why is there no certainty? For one thing, I feel very little certainty about myself in my relation to music and in my capacity to act upon my musical needs. As well. This is reminding me of an orchestral piece by Arthur Fiedler, by the way.
Ah, good. Well, we'll try to accommodate you.
Let's jump into one of your pieces, then we'll come back and ask you some questions that you can avoid answering about.
Okay.
Yeah, where's a good place to start?
We shall listen to...
I think we've already begun.
Yes, we shall listen to piece number one.
It's called Jack and Jill. You want to introduce this for us, or shall we listen
first? Yeah, I had locked myself into my studio, and I was trying to put together a...
You don't think people lock you into the studio?
It could be seen in that way without any question. Yeah. Okay. I discovered myself locked within my studio, let's say. I'll use the passive voice in that, okay?
Yeah.
And I was trying to put together a lot of things that I'd never been able to connect in my former life as a composer, because I had really gone in for, like, computer, you know, blah, 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 and very fanciful, styled thinking about the relation of music and the mind and consciousness and that kind of thing, but I didn't feel the personal relationship with music any longer, and I decided that what I wanted to do was to try to just work it through and see if I could connect the different dots that had presented themselves over the course of my former compositional life that, you know, were part of my drive. One was the important thing were cartoons, not like John Zorn type of, you know, veneration of cartoon music, but the whole thing and trying to figure out, is there a way to make cartoons in music? And
you apparently love cartoons. We were talking before the show that you started out with like the Farmer Gray cartoons, and you had this period
Alfalfa,
of time. Period of time in the what I think you considered the bad era of cartoons, where they used the single character whose mouth would move and sometimes whose feet would move and then just sort of moved on the glass.
Yeah. Well, I absolutely love cartoons. I identify with them totally. And like also I think talking earlier about Sigmund Freud coming to New York and looking at Coney Island and saying, well, here's the unconscious made visible. And I also had this very strong feeling that there was a kind of like unconsciousness that I wanted to be able somehow or other to explore or within myself. And I thought that this could be done, you know, by a kind of cartooning style, as it were, it didn't work out like that at all, but I came up with something that seemed to me like a kind of musical animation. It was sort of like a musical correlate to computer animation where we move around things. Anyhow, let's listen maybe just to get the idea because I can never explain this.
Sit back, relax.
Yeah, it's a very short piece. This is a 30-second piece.
That just blew my whole introduction to it. I don't know. These guys that have radio says they jump all over you. Here it is, 42 seconds worth of Jack and Jill.
That's all, folks.
No, it isn't. That's just the beginning.
Oh, right.
We've just begun.
Of course.
Music by Elliot Handelman. Very brief. Shall we hear it more than once? I think that's a good idea. We'll hear it again, but please tell more about this.
Should I talk before we hear it a second time?
Yeah.
It's funny because, I've never played this for anyone who didn't ask to hear it a second time, which I kind of think is, a good thing. It's the only piece of this kind. I made many other animations, but they never had as clear and as simple an idea as this one. And it was the first, of course. And in a certain sense, it was really just autobiographical because I was feeling very nervous at the time. I'd been working, and I wasn't happy with what I was doing.
It's a really short autobiography.
It's very compressed. It's compressed into just the basic actions that were needed. I had the idea one day of this kind of music bouncing around and exploding, and I went to work, and I explored that for a little while, and all of a sudden this piece just popped into place. And it's just really a kind of very simple parable. It's a very nervous pianist is trying to do a children's song, which happens to be misnamed, as it happens, right? Because it's really Frère et Jacques, not Jack and Jill. And it breaks up, and a tremendous buildup of hope and determination ensues. And, of course, the thing is just going to explode the second time. You know it from that point on. And a little voice comes out of the end. And the little voice I had pictured to myself as my own struggle to get my own voice, which is what this had really all been about.
Packing into just half a minute, all of that. Incredible. Here it is, Jack
and
Jill.
I think it's very funny to talk for half an hour.
Well, we'll talk about how you took, never mind, the years with Mary Had a Little Lamb or whatever it was. We'll be back. Here it is. Elliot Handelman. To love that piece. No time at all. Well, what about this sort of looking at these short things and what they mean. We were again talking before the show, and you said you spent how long was it trying to make sense out of the melody "Happy Birthday"? You have
okay.
In the process of analysis.
That's another thing.
Maybe you can
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is totally unrelated. I started doing that kind of stuff like years after this. We were talking earlier about my feeling about music and vision, and how I think that at a brain level, that processing of music, the way in which music seems to happen to us so that we encounter it as music, is something that I think, I'm just guessing because I haven't done like the brain research here, that we're processing music more or less the way in which the eye is doing vision, which the visual brain is doing vision. And, we are visual. And where does music fit into all of this picture? In Jack and Jill, one of the things that I was trying to do was to make a musical image that would be so compressed and detailed that you could really just hold it in the whole thing in your mind without any difficulty. Supposedly, you get to Beethoven and that kind of thing, you have people saying, you can imagine the whole Third Symphony sort of in one moment. There's the famous story about how Mozart, it's the forged letter in which Mozart talks about how he composes, and he says at a certain moment he hears the whole thing simultaneously, and it's like this enormous banquet of sound, this festival of sound that he hears all at once.
So you're thinking about image rather than narrative.
In a way, they're the same. I'm trying to narrate something that is happening within the music. I'm trying to present characters. There are three characters. There's the piano, the celesta, and the harp, right? And the central, of course, is the who are cheering on the piano on the side. The piano is the great virtuoso who explodes at the end, as it were, realizing an idea anticipated in your essay.
Of course. Well, I knew that.
Which idea was that? I don't have a very long memory.
Right, but you do have the long recording.
Oh, well, I could do this if you'd like.
Oh, sure.
Hi, I'm Jason Eckhart, and you're listening to Calvis and Damian's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
I guess that's all he says.
That's all he says.
Here on the Non-Pop International Network on WGDR Plainfield.
They already said flagship, so never mind. Or we did part of that. Anyway.
Okay.
Doesn't matter.
Well, let's get back then, since we have done our business, as we like to do our business.
You didn't hear that because you had your ears off.
Yeah, no, I am allergic to headphones. I'm allergic to anything with head in it.
Wait a minute, unless it's your own, apparently.
That's where you're wrong.
Well, let's get back. I really want to get back to the idea of image. And because it seems to me that at one point when you said, and again not here, I have to refer back to earlier this morning because we spent about 4 hours together this morning talking about these issues, that you don't believe in the chord. What did that mean? I never followed that, and I think that's a really sort of good thing to explore at this point because
okay.
It might have to do with a little bit of this.
Visuality, I don't believe in the chord. Well, what I mean by that is that, well, that's just a kind of technical point about, how music theory goes and is obsessed with harmony. And I guess that I personally am less obsessed with harmony or feel less capable in harmony, maybe, or think that music is more about not expanding a chord, but expanding a linear, just a line,
which
moving.
Which even the small piece has done.
Yeah.
Even though there were incidental harmony as part of it.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course, because, that was just the setup, right? Setup punch.
Exactly,
but,
yeah.
I think in my music, the main thing, there are two things that I'm interested in. Well, I guess there are many things that I'm interested in. One is definitely movement is one of the main things that concerns me, and a kind of kinematic movement that is like, the kind of springy boyo-yoing sounds that you get in cartoons, where you get like these cartoons by, what's his name, that great genius,
Tex Avery?
Yeah, Tex. Yeah. All I have to do is say the great genius, and you know who I mean. Yeah, where the character is going, rebounding from one wall off another, and his eyes are getting huge, and that kind of thing. So that kind of movement, to me, somehow or other, like, is realizes visually something that music has never done, but which should do, or which I would like to do. At any case, and also connects with one of my central, great preoccupations, namely the computer, and trying to figure out a way to use the computer in making music that feels satisfactory, like as a means of exploring new terrains and going into new possibilities, rather than using the computer as a tool to make it easier to do the kinds of things that we've already done. So this is a very big thing.
Well,
so movement is very important. And the third thing, the other thing of the two things that I'm mentioning here that is of central importance to me is the voice, and trying to figure out a way to use the voice. The voice is also interesting to think about from the point of view of sound perception, because things are happening in the voice at a very, very rapid pace. We are disambiguating all kinds of different sounds in a way that happens much, much faster than when we have specialized centers, you know, to do with this kind of thing. So I think of music as, or some of the music that I've worked on, as also trying to explore possibilities at the speed of speech. It's not necessarily talking, but when we think about Western music, where all of this flatness, we have these flat, long notes that, you know, maybe you add some vibrato and that kind of thing. Then you think about, like, Asian music that has all of these complex pitch inflections and that kind of thing. For myself, because voice is so important, the sense, first of all, of finding my own voice, but also the sense because I would like music to speak, or I would like music to cast images or something like that. It means sort of like jacking up the speed of music to that of speech so that it becomes processed by different centers, as it were, the speech centers. I don't know how successful I've been at that.
Which is that why you
part of the jacking,
is that why you focus on the melody aspect of it? Because there's so much going on if you add the harmony in terms of ambiguities?
Yeah, because I'm seeing music, first of all, as movement, and second of all, as speech or a speech movement.
Yeah.
Okay? And harmony is a special magical thing that happens in nature, okay, that we can prove using experiments with, like, you know, the octave exists and the perfect fifth exists and that kind of thing. And it makes us feel that there's a natural basis for music, that many people have spent lots of time trying to figure out what is the natural basis of music. How does it exist in nature? You know, there's the overtone series provides the chord of nature. And I feel music is completely brain-centered. It's not about nature at all. It's totally about how not only the brain but the mind works. So instead of pursuing the idea of what is the truth of music that I can find in the chord of nature or in harmony? What is the truth not only of music, but of myself? What is my creative truth? If I conceive of music strictly as a product of the human mind, of the brain, happening at, you know, in a way that the thing is constructed specifically to be understood by humans, by the human brain. We don't even know in what way it's meant to be understood. We don't know why a melody is a melody, really. We just have vague ideas. So I spent a lot of time studying some basic melodies.
And you have analytical tools you've developed to do that.
Yeah, a system that is actually called Jack.
Part of the Jack and Jill?
Yeah. Yeah.
I see.
I understand there's a bit of a language problem on the show. Or
we have a very serious language problem.
Okay.
So we don't speak English.
Okay. Right. So Jack has various connotations that are probably also pertinent to my way of conceiving music that we need not explore over here.
Over here, but
over the airwaves.
Yeah, is what I mean. Yeah.
I think I need to hear something else.
Do you?
All right.
Let's do that.
Okay.
We have a couple more pieces to choose from here. What should we listen to next? Then we can get back, because I really want to pursue some of the analytical questions that you had brought up.
Well, one of the big problems that I had with Jack and Jill was it was rather short, and I wanted to try to expand it in some way. And one of the things that I felt disappointed with in that piece was that the explosion at the end was really, it was simple, but I wanted to be able to somehow expand it into, like, a big thing where it would be not a representative, just a not like that. You know, it was just a kind of, like, simple wave. But to somehow invent a kind of kinematic force that would be throwing things around, like the Boy Yoings, you know, Tex Avery and that kind of thing. So this is actually my latest piece. It's called White-Themed, and it begins with a kind of, like, rather rhetorical type of simple variations and suddenly switches to something that gradually emerges into this exploration of how I could expand some kind of explosive kinematic force and into something like a larger form where you would have a couple of seconds to actually get into it if you enjoyed it.
Now, this is an electronic piece, or is this
it's a
live piece?
Yeah, it's just a strictly Sound Blaster piano, because it was originally going to be a piano concerto for MIDI piano and orchestra, and I kind of lost interest in doing this. So I just made it. It was a Sound Blaster, and I like modest means. You know, I don't have to have the greatest, world's greatest samples to do anything. You know, I'm just trying to create movements.
They live beyond the...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so here, white themed. Our guest is Elliot Handelman. Let's start that one again, because we had it already running. Here we go. All right, we're ready to go back.
Thank you.
Elliot Handelman, white themed. Well, that brings up...
Not white noise, but white theme. Mm. Mm.
Brings up lots and lots and lots of questions.
Ask away.
All right.
Fire away.
Yeah, I had to write them down. There were so many. Of course, the first reaction, I think, that I had is that how can one escape whenever talking about a mechanical device sounding like that, whether it's a Sound Blaster piano or not, how can one escape the kind of rhythmic and melodic excesses, if you want to call them, of a Nancarrow?
Well, I don't know. I don't think this reminds me at all of Nancarrow. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting that because of the medium and because of the incredible number of high-speed running figures.
But they're different from Nancarrow's because they're much more florid and... you know, for me, it was mainly a study, this piece. Mm-hmm. As I said,
it shares the name. Even.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. But that's okay because, like, you know, I know that Nancarrow may have had a kind of idealized music that he wanted to realize that he had to hit at many different ways mm-hmm. in order to try to come towards. I completely identify with this thing. You know, as I said, what I mainly wanted to do was to try to create a study which would give me an opportunity to plan out larger scale ejaculations, as it were, and, you know, to do so in my way, that is to say, because I think it's a lyrical piece, you know, with hummable themes, which I'm sure you can probably get at.
All right, well,
after another seven listenings.
Hummable themes in that sort of range of extremes, and you know, where is that role of the theme? Where is the role of the melody, if you'll take that one on? And what's the sort of expectation of perception in this piece?
Okay, well, it is basically, I wouldn't call it an animation in sin, because animation for me connotes a specific kind of, well, narration that definitely presents itself. The kinematic effects that are going to happen are something that you can easily relate to reality. Like, it sounds like a piano exploding, and the piano is going to try again, you know, and the harp fell on top of the violin or something like that. These are things that can be represented in ways that I think any listener will be able to hear, okay? In this piece, I was just more interested in, like, trying to formulate a more abstract kind of energy. But on the other hand, this also always raises a problem for me because I don't really know how to go into complete abstraction and just make, like, abstract painting. I don't really know what that is. There's always a kind of figure ground relation for me. I'm a kind of guy, something that, you know, maybe comes out a little bit more clearly in Jack and Jill, kind of have like a very serious attachment to low-life kind of music, player piano stuff, boogie-woogie, barrel house, you know, schlocky music. I love Jelly Roll Morton. That's not schlocky, you know. This is great music in many ways. You know, the kind of stuff that, you know, of course, film music that we were talking about earlier and that kind of thing. So I want to kind of narrate or relate a kind of conflicting energy that is happening within a piece, and I seem to need to have to relate that to having, if I don't have characters, if it's not really an animation, then at least it, you know, it has to have a sense of theme. The theme there, I think it was kind of mysterious for me. There are many unresolved issues for me in that piece. Maybe the piece isn't really finished in that case. I say it's finished. I say, I don't want to do this anymore.
You're done with it, in other words. Yeah, it's not necessarily finished, but you're done with it.
I think I'll just shelf it. You know, nobody's ever going to want to perform it, so that isn't an issue. It's not performable, right?
Oh, we don't know that.
Okay. Okay.
Why do you say it is not performable?
Okay. That was a very good point.
Well, wait a minute. That's not an answer.
Well, I'm agreeing with you. I mean,
No, you're not supposed to.
I'm very ambivalent about many things, you know. And,
no, you're not.
Okay, I'm not really ambivalent about many things. So it's like, although it may seem, you know, the theme has a kind of very rhetorical function in this thing. I went through, it didn't sound right to me, I must say, sitting in the studio. But it seemed to me that it needed a kind of simple and obvious weight at the beginning of the whole thing. And that would gradually, you know, infiltrate its way through the piece But I don't know. It's, you know, it's unanalyzed for me why I felt I needed to do that. As I say, I was really just more interested in exploring the energy. But, you know, there's like a kind of issue of what is the background to this? What is the, you know, why is this happening? You can't just make explosions, or I can't, just because it feels fun to make explosions. It seems to demand a kind of motivation.
So what is the motivation, and what is the piece's integrity? It certainly has the explosives. It certainly is compelling. It doesn't lose you from beginning to end. What is that glue?
Well, I'm not really sure. I think it that the glue is really a kind of very traditional sense of thematicism that is in conflict with a completely extraneous purpose. It has very simple, memorable themes, I think. Maybe, you know, that reappear in very obvious ways. There seem to be cadential sections. There is a new theme introduced at the right moment, or what seems to me to be the right moment. There is a subsidiary development that, I mean, I didn't really plan it that way.
Oh, so this is arbitrary, or was it? Did you set up some sort of an algorithm to produce this, or how did you write this anyway?
Okay, part of the issue for me was that, as I said, it was a study, and part of it is a study for what I thought at the time, because now once I write a piece, now my complete thinking about everything has completely changed, so it's back to square one. Back to the old drawing board. I didn't want to write this piece by hand. I wanted this to be the product of like a kind of really alien artificial mind that could dream music. That's what I wanted to do. And this piece was really, as I began it, just a sketch for what I thought the system should be able to produce, the kind of thing involving, you know, collisions and interactions and that kind of thing. So as I was writing the piece, I was developing a system in which the piece was developing, and I called it a collider system. And the whole thing just, you know, became very complicated and difficult to use. So I used all of the raw material that I produced for that over some months, quite a few months, really, just intuitively reassembling and constructing things and using that as the raw kind of lines or spirals or figures. These are not things that you could do in an ordinary sequencer because it's like it was a lot of notes with everything with intense dynamic variation, curves and that sort of thing. So it was like when I had abandoned the piece the first time, when I'd had enough of it, I had sort of like a beginning of the piece and a million billion Sparajaras to screw around with and try to make a piece with. So it's like trying to make a piece, you know, it's those game that kids have where you have the felt, you know, or that is to say kids used to have where you have the felt and you put the smile over here, that kind of thing.
Those little graph things with the gears, those sort of spirographs? You start out with a visual image? Is that what we're talking about here? Did you start out with a actual, either in your mind or on paper, an actual visual image as source material?
No, rather with a vague feeling, as I always do, that I hope telescopes into a very precise feeling about what the need or demand of a specific situation might be. I mean, you know, I'm trying to compose like something that is like will seem to have its own life, and I know that I don't always succeed in allowing the thing to have its own life that I get in the way.
This thing about having its own life is really important to you. Can you sort of expand on the notion of maybe music not merely as a simple means of self-expression of some sort of vanity, but rather animating whatever words you would use?
Yeah. Well, I think I've more or less expressed myself on that. But I think that one of the deepest things that compels me in music and that makes it seem like so much deeper than anything else that I know is precisely the feeling that I have, which for all I know is just a misunderstanding, right? It's my own weird way of thinking about music that doesn't make sense to anyone else, is that music feels to me like a kind of externalized, living thinking. Ferrez used the expression that music is is intelligence made expressed by way of sounds. And I, you know, Tom was saying that I assume that Ferrez isn't saying that we're expressing intelligence and that I have a high IQ. and I want to demonstrate to the world how smart I am by manipulating sounds in some kind of way. I hate that. No kind of art can be about that. Okay? To me, my master is Kafka in this thing. Right? You know, I mean, art, making music is not about showing off how intelligent you are or what kind of technique you have. If anything, it's the contrary. It's showing off how small you are, or at least so in a dubious conversation with Kafka. I mean, Janusz says that Kafka says that the poet is actually a much smaller man than other people. His feeling, his sensitivity to the world is therefore greater, and he feels it. He feels the pain. He feels the pain more acutely.
And so what did Kafka and Verez have to say about Coney Island?
It expresses, it's the unconscious made visible.
Well, that was Freud. And well, and Verez well, and Kafka said that? Well, they all believed
different,
in
different aspects. It's the same family moment.
Coney Island.
European, yeah.
Where's the audience fit in all of this?
Good question. I don't know. I don't know.
Do you have a listenership?
No.
Okay.
No, I work alone.
Okay,
I just locked myself, was suggested, yeah. into my studio to try to work out a few things, to try to, just throw myself away and work without feeling the compulsion to do anything but what my own drives seem to be dictating. That turned into being an extremely complicated thing that I had to try to expand by, like, you know, not, you know, okay. Maybe I need to use my mind more and feel a little less because I'm dissolving in here, is the thing. Right?
What about the whole idea that music is a form of communication?
I don't know if it is.
All right.
I don't know if it is.
What dissuades you from thinking that?
What dissuades me that music is a form of communication? Because we can never verify the message. We can never tell whether the guy got what we intended to say, if it is a form of communication. I mean, we've just been sitting here and listening to one of my pieces. I really have no idea what it sounds like to anyone else. I wish I could tell, but wouldn't you have to be able to tell me that?
Well, no, that would be translated into words. Now, if we were in an improvisatory situation, yeah. maybe we would have a response that would indicate to you whether we got it by improvising musically with it.
Yeah, there would be a kind of direct view. Yeah, but, okay, that's a communication among the musicians, but even so, not all people who attend improvisations are necessarily participating. So there might be a communication between performers, as there's a communication between a conductor, let's say, and the first violinist. There undoubtedly is, but we can't say for that reason, oh, well, music is communication or a form of communication. I think music is more basic than communication.
Which is what?
I think it's
a gratification.
No, I think it's about the whole possibility and hope of a kind of shared experience, of experiencing a kind of as we go to a concert or to a dance or to a rave or whatever, and we wind up feeling or imagining that we're all feeling the same thing at the same time. And we don't really know, so it's not necessarily communication because nothing is being communicated. But there's kind of communal sense that a common emotional thing, a common complex thing, a not verbal thing, not a message, not a thing with a specific agenda, okay, a form of knowledge or something like that, is being imparted to us as a kind of pure experience, and we're all collectively involving it. And I think that must have a great deal to do with the fact that, well, you know, inner life is something that, except for the ways in which we can try to imagine that we can express these things as a movie, as a novel, a poem, or whatever, is an indefinite private thing that we go around with, burdened by. And I feel externalizing this, or, you know, I mean, I'm simplifying a little. I don't know.
No, you're intellectualizing this.
Okay.
This is a lot more simple than this.
Okay.
Let's just hear another goddamn piece.
Okay. Okay. The next thing that I got is a sort of kvetchy piece.
Well, we'll kvetch for you.
Yeah. Okay.
What is it? To explain it, or at least tell us a little bit. No, don't explain it.
I thought it was technically soundless over there.
Just
I was
tell us
like,
what
yes.
it is.
I just call it concert. It's a piece in which I was, again, exploring the possibilities of making kind of fake orchestra using samples and that kind of thing. I was not working in a MIDI sequencer, so I was not restricted to the kinds of things that you can do using conventional notation. I was specifically interested in trying to get to a kind of orchestral music that would be like more like speaking. It came out more like a kind of weeping, a kind of kvetching, croaking. Does the word kvetch need to be explained around here? Probably.
Not at all. We do it all the time on this show.
Okay.
Next week we'll do it about you.
I'm sure. So the kvetching with all of this warbling and tremoring in the throat still seemed,
We're just enhancing a little pantomime here.
Yeah. Okay, so it's kind of like a two movement type of thing with, you know, a weeping section at the end and then something strange happens. And
do we dare ask when you wrote it? Does that have any bearing on?
I don't really know because I just have a whole bunch of stuff that I work out whenever I want to. I think this is from a few years ago.
Oh,
I don't date things. I'm sorry.
All right, then I think we'll hear it.
Thank you.
Elliot Handelman's our guest on Calvis and Damien. That was Concert, and you don't remember exactly when you wrote that piece.
Yeah, it was from a few years ago.
Three,
four, I don't
know. Well, more questions than we can possibly ask in one radio program about that. First of all, the process of, the actual technical process of putting it together. What did you use to create the sound?
Okay, well, I was working originally, when I got to work with a MIDI sequencer, I discovered a Proteus orchestral module, and that's what I wanted to do. I mean, you know, create my own orchestra and do what I want and not deal with the whole politics of trying to get a piece performed and so on and so on. But also, more importantly, to be able to experiment and to learn, because I had like two orchestral performances prior to that, and I didn't feel I really knew anything about the orchestra. I didn't have nearly the kind of experience that I had hoped to get. So I was hoping in these fake orchestras to be able to like build up ideas about how to do orchestration, how to write for orchestra, and then maybe go back to writing orchestra pieces. I somehow got caught up with the possibilities of MIDI and just... I am really interested in what can I do with a computer, not what can I do with a live orchestra. How can I use a computer to fake an orchestra so that the orchestral performance will be better, or something like that. But I got completely disgusted with what I was doing with MIDI sequencers, and I wrote my own MIDI system so that I could just do explorations with not being constrained by, you know, in a MIDI sequencer, there's a kind of, it's easy to put in quarter notes and half notes. And it's much, much harder to sketch out rhythms any right. way you want to.
Did you use a kind of a visual input for this? Did you draw these shapes as for input? How did you get them in there?
Well, I tried that. I tried okay. drawing. I wrote a little interface that I could draw MIDI, but I found that was no good. That was too laborious and unpredictable anyways. So I just worked. I just start with an idea and experiment and keep going. And so if I like something, I would push that envelope.
Is it like a keyboard input? Is it a
no?
It's
all
completely. What sort of interface do you use, or is it typed in as number streams?
No. It's I was very. I there's something about this that it's as though I don't really want to admit, listener. I don't want to portray myself as a composer who is sort of involved with writing computer programs. The music that I've written for me always primarily served the problem of trying to realize my ideas about animation, my ideas about how to create an expression which was appropriate for, which felt natural to me, which was my music, my voice, that kind of thing. So the way in which I go about, where, you know, the whole computational baggage doesn't seem to me very interesting.
Well,
relevant.
I know that our listeners, among our listeners, are people who are saying, how can I do that?
Okay. I don't know how you could do this using conventional stuff, but you could definitely do it better than me. My audio chops are not so great. You know, I tend to think about music more just like his music, and you leave it to the instrumentalist, and he gets the good sound, or she gets the good sound.
So you're going to dodge this question.
How can if the listener is asking, how can I do this?
Do you have a program you sell?
I see what you're saying.
Can you give them software with this interface? And
well, what you need is a program where you can compute MIDI, and then you have to be able to compute. And,
okay.
You know,
right. So,
you can get stuff off the net.
Good.
At the time I did this, I mean, I wanted, you know, I don't like using other people's systems, but you can get equivalent systems like CM by Heinrich Taube, I think would probably give you a lot of power. You could do, you know, pretty much what you wanted to do. I like being totally uninfluenced by other people's design decisions because, you know, I think that those ultimate. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I'm just very funny.
Software heavily influences how you work.
I think it does.
Yeah. Next question is, do you have any experience with the work of Manfred Kleins, who talked about musical figures as being cross-cultural?
Sure. I know Manfred. I haven't spoken to him in many years. I was very interested in his idea about syntics. He had an idea that there are certain kinds of movements that could be expressed. Let's say, you know, we could feel them like when you press somebody's, you put your thumb into someone's palm and you press it, you can communicate all kinds of different emotions just by how you're pressing it. If you're digging in very quickly and pulling out, that would be kind of like very aggressive. But you could also connote love or happiness and that kind of thing simply by the pressure of movement. So he thought that maybe the way in which we understand emotions has a lot to do with those kinds of effective pressure curves. And he thought, well, maybe music uses those curves, and that's one way of getting to the affectivity. Why is music an emotional experience for us? Why is music about feeling and that kind of thing? And, you know, maybe because there's a continuum between hearing and touch, and music is perhaps. I think I'm adding a little to his ideas here.
The reason I asked the question is because the sound that what you called the weeping or whatever it was had the sense of some of those basic raw figures that he was using in his experiment, like that boing. Which he said, what is that? You know, I'm going to use that, and I'm going to go to the Australian outback, and I'm going to go to Inner Mongolia, and I'm going to go to, you know, all these places which are rarely touched by broadcast and other influences, and say, what does this connote to you? And I was struck by almost their very skeletal form right there, sort of weeping at me out of that piece.
Yeah, well, the strange thing for me was that it began, that music seems to begin like a kind of typical, you know, you want to make music that seems to weep, so you're going to go like, yeah. But what I find interesting in what happened there, which was partly, you know, I say interesting because, like, many interesting things happen accidentally, was how the beginning and ends of these would become more and more articulated, so that finally when this chord comes in, if anybody can remember, the first chord, there's like this kind of, it's actually a trumpet, which unfortunately with all of this processing tends to lose a bit of its identity. It seems to be going, it seems very, very human in the way in which the pitch and the volume of the thing is being changed. It seems to have arrived at a way of manipulating pitch that gets us to a feeling of well, this is a human voice. This is expressing something. Why this is, I don't really know. Okay, but and it would be really, really fascinating for me to pursue the direction. In fact, I have a project set up which involves a kind of talking orchestra thing, in which we'll have to talk very intelligibly with all of the instruments, using an approach that has been developed by auditory psychologists called sine wave synthesis, in which you can synthesize speech just using sine wave. And I think all of this can be mapped to an orchestra. So what you can do is you can make a piece that would be like a talking jig, or something like that. It would be, I'd like to make a much simpler kind of music than this kind of fetching, abstract.
We were talking about a number of these things, including a composer by the name of Clarence Barlow, and he, in his large orchestral piece, had the orchestra speak. There are places in which the orchestra, through the use of additive harmonics, says things like, no money. I forget what the other. He has three phrases very funny phrases that are done by the synthesis of these harmonics.
Yeah.
In the violins, this is orchestrally. This is not a synthetically. It's really quite.
Yeah. Well, I find that I don't really. James Tenney also did a piece like this, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. In which he sort of figured out the spectrum of different vowels, or got some chart and figured out how to make orchestrations in which this would happen. But I'm not, how clearly do we hear, because I haven't heard this Barlow piece, I've just read about it. How clearly do we hear the words?
You hear the words only if you know them, but they jump out at you once you know what they are.
Okay.
Because, of course, there's no articulated consonant particularly. It's mostly the vowel remnants.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you could, the thing is that the trick is not just to generate speech, but, when I was a kid, I had this recording called Sparky's Magic Piano. Now, you remember that one, which, sounded like the piano was talking to Sparky. And he said, Sparky, it was just a vocoder or something. I am your piano, and why aren't you practicing me? And it would sound like a piano talking. Or it sounded to me when I was a kid like a piano talking. So I guess that
you were just terrified of your piano. That's all. You had nightmares about it. You're a nightmare person, aren't you? You love nightmares.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I'm a dreamist. What should one call a dreamist? What is the Greek term?
A traumatist?
What is the Greek term for dreams? Escapes me at the moment. Okay.
Thanatopsician.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll accept that. many things tend to appear to me in dreams. I dream music rather extensively. And have
whole pieces or parts or just a concept or what do you hear it in the dream?
Yeah. I can often remember, but I think that what I'm dreaming is some kind of strange cross modality with all of the senses, so that although I can retain for years afterward the feeling of a certain music, I find I still don't even know how to begin to write it down, but I could clearly recognize it if I heard it. So I sort of work towards actually the realization of the dream music is, of course, a very interesting thing to me if I could do it. But the music that I hear is not necessarily very nice music. I mean, one music that I was dreaming was, it was this kind of animation. It was this moving music that was moving, and it revolted me. It had this awful flavor, and I thought, this is the most powerful music I've ever heard. I must stop and listen to it, even though it's just disgusting me.
What? All right.
When I woke up in the morning, I was thinking about it and thinking, now, what did this feel like? And it occurred to me that there was a sausage that I'd once tasted in Germany, in Berlin, that was utterly disgusting. I couldn't get through it. I mean, I'll try to eat anything, right? And if at first I'm disgusted, it doesn't matter. I'll try to get through it anyway and try to convince myself this is actually good. I couldn't get through the sausage, and the music reminded me of that sausage. So this is clearly something that is just happening within my brain. But at the same time, it's giving me a very specific sense of reference, and I can still feel that kind of music, for example. So, yeah.
And a piece like this, do you number yourself among the spectralists?
What kind of piece?
The piece we've just heard.
Oh, absolutely not. I have nothing to do with spectralism. That piece was, as I say, a kind of... It was a type of speech piece, you might say, in which, once again, I was finding out a way, trying to find a way to talk without necessarily very much ability to control what was being said. But at the same time, accepting that, okay, I can animate some kind of force somehow or other. At the very end of the piece, there's this kind of voice that comes in that sounds like Darth Vader, and he says, Vadandara! Ha ha ha! I didn't plan it this way. I didn't decide. The guy will say Vadandara, and everybody, it sounds like the orchestra responds, Ohio! And I don't know how that happened, but there it was. Here is this guy saying, Vadandara! Ha ha ha! So I added the science fiction effects before because okay, that was clearly me. The rest of it was the unseen forces that come when one simply works and hopefully things happen without one necessarily knowing why they happen.
Our guest is Elliot Handelman, and he's going to do a little business for us right about now.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
There's another, yes.
Hello, hi, bonjour, hallo, hola, ciao, salame dantang, or your personal greeting. My name is blank. My name is Elliot Handelman. You're listening to Calvis and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop. I run a radio show in Montreal called Where's the Beat, and I often say to my listeners, turn down that volume, get onto the internet, and log on to Calvis, listen to the show, listen to Calvis and Damien on the Non-Pop International Network.
Here on WGDR Plainfield. Wow. By the way, our telephone, this show this time, at least on this particular day, is live. And the number is 802-454-7762 if you'd like to ask Elliot a question. In the meantime, maybe you could introduce this next piece and whether or not you should warn our listening audience to put away their children.
Okay. Are we going to do this? This is a 20-minute piece.
Yes, of course, because we're tired of talking to you.
Okay.
So we want to listen to
this is a piece in which I'm actually talking.
Have you processed your voice?
No, it's just straight talking. It's a piece that begins and ends with music, and in the center I am trying to analyze a dream that I've had. The dream involves two composers. One was Claude Vivier, who was killed in Paris, and the other is John Rea, who was one of my teachers at McGill University many years ago, became a personal friend when he did a bit of time in Berlin. I was absorbed for years just trying to figure out how to do a voice piece in which I would talk, and this is as close as I've come. So I guess this is a study as well. This is called Montreal.
Un son.
It involves two other composers, one of whom is dead, but has returned to his place of origin, Montreal, although certain complications have arisen. His name is Vivier, an anagram of English I and French vivre, I live, or French I and French vivre, to live there. The other composer is John Rea, the missing I from vivre, the I not living. Together with those letters I get Ira, a requiem, dealing with the desire to live, the problem how to join I with life, and whether I embrace that solipsism.
Owned!
I was with John, and we were going to see Claude Vivier, who had died in Paris, but now he was somehow living in Montreal, although certain complications had arisen. John thought that he should go first and find out whether Vivier was approachable that day. While he was doing this, I went around to the back of the car, where we had our vegetables, in three bags, two belonging to John, one belonging to me, and I'd planned to take mine into the back seat of the car, but mistakenly took John's. John came back, and he said, "Let's go up," and the dream ends there. It has something to do with a kind of ideological suicide. I don't know the details of Vivier's final sojourn in Paris, but I gathered that he'd had a sense of mission about playing a seminal role in the reconciliation of the Arabs and the Jews, and that he'd been broaching disaster for some time, and that he might have wanted to martyr himself. I don't know how true any of this is, but I know that I must have identified. I met Claude at John Reyes. I was visiting Montreal from Berlin. We had dinner, and then Claude took me to visit some of his gay bars, where he introduced me as a composer from Berlin. I was the center of attention because people wanted to see what a real composer looked like. They asked me questions like, "Why aren't your eyes blue? Why isn't your hair blonde?" And I said, "Well, I'm not actually German. I'm from here." And they gave me a second chance, and they said, "Well, your parents must be from Germany." And I said, "No, they're from here." And they gave me a third chance. "You must have ancestry," which I could probably admit to, but that gets into the tricky discussion about being Jewish. So they lost interest because I wasn't able to offer them contact with reality. What's the point of telling the truth when nobody's interested? So when Claude introduced me for the third time as a composer from Berlin, and an older gentleman asked me, "How do you find Montreal?" I said, "Well, of all of the cities I've so far seen in my North American tour, Montreal is the most European." And he said, "Oh, you don't know how happy you've made me by saying that. What's wrong with Montreal?" I knew this just as well as he did. Montreal is okay, because it's not like other places in North America. I personally felt New York is more like Europe, but I'm also not from New York. I'm from Montreal. In the dream, Vivier came back to Montreal. Although there's a kind of weirdness, there's some sort of mediation that's involved, and John Rea is being like a guide. Vivier means I live, or to live there, which probably means Montreal. You take the I away from Vivier, then you get an anagram of vivre, to live, which is exactly what I didn't want to do in Montreal. And if you stick the extra I in Rea, then you get Ire, like the Dies Ire, which is a requiem, so it brings together death and music. Ire is the wrath of judgment, the self-judgment that you get by absorbing an I that belongs to someone else, like a self-scanning ocular eye. If you just go back to the name Rea without the extra eye, then the line of associations goes to Era, which in my limited Italian gets to Era Smarita, the line about being lost in the middle of life and finding yourself in the dark woods. So the dream is sort of like the story of the poet who visits his own chaos and encounters his teacher, who guides him through so that he finally gets to his beloved Beatrice, whom John named his daughter after. In this case, it's about living. And I'm shuffling around bags of vegetables, two of which belong to John, and one belongs to me. And I'm trying to separate them, but I make a false identification. And that ties in with the memory I have of how Claude introduced me as a composer from Berlin, and it reveals something screwy happening with the projections of my self-judgment. And the bags of vegetables, that I'm shuffling around, two belong to John, one is mine, are vegetating as I am. I'm carrying around stuff that doesn't belong to me. I'm moving around bags of vegetables. In German, vegetables are Gemüse, which sounds like music. It just sounds like music, but it isn't, and it's prefixed by ge, which in German means it's in the past tense, so like the past of music, or the pastness of music. Or maybe the feeling that by music, what I really mean is German music, because gen, German, je. And I remember a story that Claude told me that night about how he'd had a long technical discussion about a piece by Stockhausen, who was his teacher, with a composer that he was butt-fucking, and he was miming the gestures of pleasure and total involvement, so that's how important German music is.
it has that kind of primacy. And I guess also gay music is gay music, which could mean clothes music, or music filled with a libidinal primacy. And that was really the core of my whole problem. I was trying to think this through and how music had become for me a powerful symbol of the way the consciousness could be elucidated or even reconstructed, a kind of basic mind-altering technology that could keep going, maybe develop, become something new, whose past would have been musical, like gay music, but that would have been a way of knowing, just as in the past music was a way of feeling, so that knowing and feeling could be more or less the same thing, like a brilliant intuition. But at the same time, all of this seemed conjoined with a kind of irrational violence, like my wish to shatter the ego and insinuate all kinds of weird perception-altering operators there. And I'd come to the point where I just wanted to try to see what it all really meant. So I decided to try to analyze myself, to sort out all of the splits within me, the different eyes. Let one part act, do the another part do the analysis. I had the idea that I could do this by trying to locate the center of my drive in music and work completely intuitively. I freely dip into all of my associations and identifications. I just become anything. I'd feel my way through. Maybe the result could be like a kind of self-analytical symphony. At worst, it's just a notepad held by my inner analyst. At best, maybe I get direct intuitive attachment. I felt I had no choice. So I went back to Montreal, and I shut myself off with this new project. I started listening to music in a new way. From Beethoven onwards, all music is a kind of self-analysis. It's like extended Franz Kafka, where you reach into yourself and you allow the flood of chaos to generate images that might penetrate through into reality. Listen to Cloud's music, for example. He's offering big clues with titles like Lonely Child, with some complication about finding the mother who abandoned him, singing to himself in his imagined mother's voice. I could feel how each interval animated a gesture of hope or despair, abandonment, reconciliation. Also, in this directly expressive music, so much is dependent on not retracing the intervallic paths taken by other composers, which would confuse any personal expressive purpose. And it became clearer and clearer to me how in the 20th century there's this tremendous conflict between expressive need and the means available and how the individual is going to die unless somehow music gets totally rejuvenated with a totally new set of possibilities that are immediate, engaging. They aren't about, that's been done, that's been done. This reminds me of that. That sounds like this, and so on. And I became totally and completely obsessed with this issue. And I found it to be my own latent disaster. The latent disaster that is contained within the whole problem of self-expression. Or the problem of music developing, being a language, serving self-analytical goals. And this became my cause, my clode, my mission. And if I needed to martyr myself to the possibilities of the individual by shutting myself up and letting myself be filled by a total darkness, that was okay. Because if it brought about a contact with the dead, with Claude, with other people whose purposes had also been incomplete, they happened to intersect with my own, who stood beside my bed in the middle of the night when I bolted upright, who left messages for me in their poetry, in their music, who called to me from my windowsill, who inserted strange speech-like utterances into the music that I was writing, that was okay because I was helping from my corner to participate in nature's basic purpose, which is to create consciousness. The constant anxiety that I felt was only a side effect of my having attained contact, and the difficulty I had breathing only meant that I could feel music for the first time. When my mind became a physical organism that imploded and traced a million trajectories of self-accusation, there was still one possibility. I could transform those trajectories into an auditory analog, however crude, however badly made, that literally would capture the basic give and take of my own raw sound.
Un son.
Music by our guest, Elliot Handelman. That's Montreal. Should stop using those McDonald's brand CDs, though.
Yeah, I kind of left it all to chance, didn't I? but I usually do.
Just quick question. You end up with Let's Go Up. Do you have a place to go up to?
There was, I guess that underlying the dream was there was this kind of implosion and the idea of a kind of self-caricature by revealing the nature of the implosion by making an auditory analog. In the dream ends with John saying, let's go up, and it probably is the opposite of let's give up. Okay? So it actually ends with a hopeful note.
Ah, good. And as about we are about ready to, because we have to just about get up to the end of the program.
Yeah, we should say a little bit about our upcoming guests. Before a final comment or two from Elliot Handelman. Zeke Hecker's next week. And who's following Zeke?
Is it Harp Lady?
It might be Susie Allen. Not sure. But anyway, Zeke Hecker's here live in the studio next week. Damien Only will be in the studio while Calvos is lounging on a Florida beach and doing family obligations, which is different from lounging. Where are you headed, Elliot? What's your next goal with your music?
My next goal? Well, I'm interested in doing the narration thing. Finally, kind of clinched itself, and I felt, you know, that seemed to like kind of add up for me, and I'd like to pursue that in depth. possibly instrumental. I kind of do like the idea of trying to create the whole mishmash myself.
So it's sort of Wagnerian in scope.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is really kind of operatic, except, you know, there is this issue, is it real or not, right? I'm not pretending one way or another, but I'm also not being very explicit about how I feel about drama.
We'll look for it. It's the end of the show. Thanks so much for joining us on Calvus and Damien.
Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. At last, Elliot Handelman. Let's go out with a little music that we started with. This is more from Eric Schwartz. This is
you
from
don't want to do number 9?
Not number 9, but number 13.
The piano goes boom? We can do that, sure. That sounds great. This is Eric Schwartz. The piano goes boom, and if there's another maybe a few seconds after that, we'll do something else just to fill in. But, gosh, piano goes boom. That sounds good to me. You ready?
Sure.
A production of Multimedia.